From NPR News, this is Weekend Edition. I'm Audie Cornish. When Gene Roddenberry created the TV series Star Trek, the suits at NBC advised him to, quote, lose the Martian. They were talking about Spock. But Mr. Spock went on to become the most beloved half-alien in network history. As part of our ongoing series In Character that explores famous American fictional characters, NPR's Netta Ulaby wondered what makes Spock so fascinating.
Fascinating.
Four syllables and one arched eyebrow. That's Spock just as much as his pointy Vulcan ears. The first time actor Leonard Nimoy said the word was in an episode where the USS Enterprise crew faced a strange, sinister entity.
It was an object, a large object of some kind that seemed to have these amazing powers to get in our way, whichever way we turned, and there was some frantic activity.
It's blocking the way.
Quite unnecessary to raise your voice, Mr. Bailey.
The energy was very high on the bridge, and the captain was shouting orders.
So Nimoy shouted out his next line with the same energy.
Fascinating. And the director, bless him, said, be different than everybody else. Do it as a scientific curiosity. And I got it. And I said, uh-huh. And I said, fascinating. I think in that moment, a very important aspect of the character was born.
Fascinating. 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 Fascinating.
I think one of the things that Gene Roddenberry wanted Spock there for was to observe the human condition, to make comment on it.
D.C. Fontana was a writer for the original Star Trek series that ran from 1966 to 1969. She says that fascinating conveyed interest, skepticism, but layered deeply in there, wonder. Leonard Nimoy found fascination in Spock's status as an outsider.
Gene Roddenberry, when he hired me to do the role, gave me a very interesting dynamic to work with, in that Spock's mother was human, his father was Vulcan. He was sort of a half-breed.
When you were 5 years old and came home stiff-lipped, anguished, because the other boys tormented you, saying that you weren't really Vulcan. I watched you, knowing that inside, the human part of you was crying.
I think that's one of the most interesting things about Spock, which was what is hidden. It's not what you get, but what you're not getting, what's hiding, what he's hiding, what peeks out occasionally.
What peeks out occasionally are emotions. One of the series' favorite gambits was to have Spock lose his mind, always under the influence of an urge to mate, a flower spore, or a germ that eliminates defense mechanisms, as in an episode called Naked Time.
I'm in control of my emotions. Control of my
It's a struggle we all face.
Henry Jenkins is a humanities professor at the Massachusetts Institute of Technology.
Are we driven by our emotions? Are we driven by our intellect? And how do we reconcile those two things?
I'm in love with you, Mr. Spock.
One of the things Jenkins studies is Star Trek fan culture. He says Spock's struggle makes him an unlikely sex symbol.
Spock is sexy for a large number of people, male and female. Many of the female fans that I've studied really are attracted to the emotional depths of this character.
I can't lose you now, Mr. Spock. I can't.
I have a responsibility to this ship.
This character who, like many men in our culture, represses outward signs of emotion, who tries to hold it all together no matter what, but who seems to be sensitive, to be sensuous at certain times, seems to have a deep affection and even passion for his relationships to Captain Kirk. This character then became the embodiment of the mystery that is masculinity.
You hide it, but you do have feeling. Oh, how we must hurt you, torture you.
I'm in control of my emotions.
Star Trek debuted during a turbulent moment in history. The Vietnam War, the feminist movement, and Spock somehow spoke to the times, says Jenkins. It was rare then, he says, to see a TV character embody two very different cultures.
In that sense, Star Trek looks ahead to a society we live in today where so many people are mixed race, mixed cultural background. I've been thinking about that a lot lately, looking at Barack Obama. There's something in the mythology that surrounds Barack Obama that seems to me echoes some of our assumptions about Spock.
Which are?
That he's someone who's been able to bridge worlds, and that particularly he's indebted to a philosophy of Idik, the Vulcan philosophy of an infinite diversity an infant combination, that someone who is of mixed race is seen as being capable of understanding both races and indeed being more open than someone who comes from a fixed cultural identity.
As it happens, Leonard Nimoy supports Obama for president. MIT professor Henry Jenkins says Nimoy's performance as Spock was a marvel of sensitivity and nuance. But he's looking forward to a new actor playing Spock in an upcoming movie. He says, like Hamlet, Spock is a character for the ages.
We can imagine seeing hundreds of different actors play Hamlet, and indeed the richness of Hamlet is seeing the differences and different interpretations of that character. With the new movie, we will for the first time see Spock as a character larger than an actor.
Fascinating.
Neda Ulaby, NPR News.
Spock has been one of the hottest names on NPR's In-Character blog, where our web community has compared him to Margaret Mead, a Tibetan Buddhist, and Tolkien's elves. You can join the conversation and nominate your own favorite characters at npr.org/in-character.
Fans of a certain TV series about four girlfriends living it up in Manhattan need wait no longer. Sex and the City, the movie, opens today. If you're not familiar with the original HBO series, here it is in a nutshell. Carrie, Miranda, Charlotte, and Samantha spend episode after sexually explicit episode looking for love, expensive shoes, and good cosmopolitans. Now the women are mostly in their 40s. Their lives have changed. Carrie might be moving into a fabulous apartment with her longtime lover known as Mr. Big.
It sounds so perfect.
Well, except for the closet, which Big says he can redo. And also he says the kitchen needs work. Of course, I don't know about that because I keep sweaters in my stove.
The fictional Carrie Bradshaw has a reputation for being a narcissist. And it's that aspect of her personality that NPR's Elizabeth Blair explores in today's installment of our series, In Character.
First, a few basics about Carrie Bradshaw. She writes a column called Sex and the City, which is all about love and relationships in Manhattan. As played by Sarah Jessica Parker, she is sassy, takes pride in her femininity, and in her unpredictable fashion sense. Take the time one of her boyfriends picked her up for a date on his motorcycle.
That's not a cab.
No, this will be much more fun. I haven't had her out on the open road for a long time.
I really can't have the helmet hair when there's a red carpet situation.
Carrie Bradshaw is unabashedly obsessed with her appearance. Sarah Jessica Parker says she just loves fashion.
She loves it as a message, as being superficial, as being frivolous, as being serious, you know, as paying homage to the design, to the workers. But she also, you know, uses it to tell a story about herself on any given day.
Is she narcissistic?
Absolutely, but I wouldn't say she's malignantly narcissistic. I would say that she has lived a single life for a long time. No children, no husband. She's responsible to and wonderfully burdened by her friendships. But that's very different than having children and a family, and so she has really been able to take care of only herself for a long time. It doesn't mean she's not interested in the world and she wouldn't help somebody. But I think it has bred a certain narcissism in her, which is, you know, it is what it is.
They say the unexamined life is not worth living. But what if the examining becomes your life? Is that living or just procrastinating?
She is absolutely a narcissist. She is absolutely self-absorbed.
Bob Thompson is the director of the Bleier Center for Television and Popular Culture at Syracuse University.
But I don't think that's necessarily a bad thing. Generally, when we call people narcissistic, we're not meaning it as a compliment. But we have to remember that for thousands of years of history, and certainly through all of American history, narcissism was something that men engaged in constantly, and it was okay. Let's remember, it was Narcissus, not Narcissa. Narcissus was a guy.
A guy who couldn't get enough of his beautiful reflection in the river. We've all got a little of him in us. Bob Thompson even believes that narcissism is part of the foundation of feminism, since women needed to take themselves seriously before they could fight for equal rights. In Sex and the City, those rights are a given. At work and at play.
Saturday night, in an effort to save money and maybe even pick up a few extra bucks, I invited the girls over for poker.
I'll buy two.
I'm in for three.
So you advocate a double standard. Women can use their sexuality to get ahead whenever possible, but men should not be allowed to take advantage of it?
No, I'm just saying that men and women are equal opportunity exploiters.
Sex and the City became so popular during its six-year run on HBO that Forbes magazine recently ran an article saying the show spawned a cottage industry worth hundreds of millions of dollars, from booze shakers to shoemakers. But like anything that becomes too popular, Sex and the City has also been an easy target for criticism. There are plenty of Carrie Bradshaw despisers out there who say she's way too obsessed with what others think of her, especially men. Jessica Gross writes for Jezebel.com, an irreverent entertainment website for women.
I sort of find it immature to be constantly having to have yourself validated by outside sources is exhausting.
But where the narcissist label does not fit the fictional Carrie Bradshaw is in her ability to be a very good friend.
Miranda, you can't make those cupcakes and live with yourself. Move away from the icing.
What'll I tell Steve?
Blame the baby. That's what they're there for.
In the new Sex and the City movie, Carrie's narcissism gets her into a lot of trouble, and her friends help get her out. And that, says Sarah Jessica Parker, is what makes her a great character.
She's complicated. She's obviously flawed. She's made terrible errors in judgment and paid for them dearly. But she's bright and curious and inquisitive, and she is a really honorable friend.
Looks like a lot of female friends are planning to see the new Sex and the City movie together. Group ticket sales have reportedly been strong. Elizabeth Blair, NPR News.
James Bond is back, but don't go looking for him on the movie screen. This is the return of the literary 007, as invented by Ian Fleming. On the 100-year anniversary of Fleming's birth, his estate has contracted with writer Sebastian Foulkes to craft a new 007 thriller in the same style. The title is Devil May Care, and it picks up where Fleming left off when he died in 1964. You may not recognize Bond, though. In the opening of the new book, he's temporarily sworn off drinking and women.
Bond stood naked in front of the mirror and looked into his face with a distaste he made no attempt to soften. "You're tired," he said out loud. "You're played out. Finished." His torso and arms bore a network of scars, small and large, that traced a history of his violent life. There was the slight displacement of his spine to the left, where he had fallen from a train in Hungary, the skin graft on the back of the left hand. Every square inch of trunk and limb seemed to contribute to the story. But he knew that it was what was in his head that counted.
That's Sebastian Foulkes, author of the new James Bond book, Devil May Care, reading from our London Bureau. So listening to that excerpt, that's not the swaggering cinematic version of James Bond we're used to. It's introspective, almost self-doubting.
That's right. Ian Fleming left his great character James Bond in a bit of a hole when he stopped writing in 64, and Bond had been brainwashed and damaged, and he didn't really know whether he was coming or going. So if I was going to carry on the series, I needed to give Bond a little time to recover, and I like to give the reader a sense that maybe he won't recover, maybe this guy is damaged beyond repair. So there's a little tension, even as the story itself is winding up quite quickly, whether our man is going to be up to what is asked of him.
Now, you're already an established literary writer. In fact, you've been on NPR for books of your own. Why did you take up this challenge of imitating someone else? I mean, especially someone as iconic as Ian Fleming.
I think that I took it up because I was curious, I was interested, and I like a challenge. Initially, I was very doubtful as to whether I could really pull this off, or not sure even that I wanted to. So I said what I would do is go away and read Ian Fleming's books again from the beginning, and if I liked them and I could see a way in which I could do something in that vein, then I'd get back to them. And I read the books, and right from the beginning, they were much, much better than I expected they'd be. I thought they would be real pulp fiction. But they had a certain charm, and what they had above all was a sense of a man in terrible danger. And within about 20 pages, you feel your heart beginning to beat a bit faster, and you're worried for this guy. Is he going to get out of this? Is he going to be okay? And so fairly quickly, I began to think this was something I could have a lot of fun doing.
Is there a particular way in which Ian Fleming wrote that you could recognize his style?
Yeah, I think the characteristic Ian Fleming style is essentially that of a newspaper man. It's a journalistic style, which is, it's short sentences, lots of verbs, Fleming wrote 2,000 words a day. It took him 6 weeks to write the books, and he was very definite that that was the way to do it. Don't look back, don't correct your prose, don't try and make it too polished, just let the pace of the story carry you through. There's always time to dress it up and polish it later. But I think what's characteristic is that although that's how he learned to write as a reporter, he manages to introduce into that a slightly lofty tone in which he is saying to the reader, well, James Bond and I know about fancy drinks, and we know what clothes to wear and how to behave and how to bet a huge amount of money at the blackjack table. But you, poor reader, you probably have never been there and you've never really experienced the sophisticated life we have.
It sounds like you've gained some sympathy for Ian Fleming and sort of the challenges he's faced with this character.
Yeah, it's not as easy to do as you think, actually. Bond, when I wanted to slow things down after a particularly important or violent piece of action, I tried to get him to reflect, or I tried to get him to be introspective, to look back on his life, but it became clear to me that I simply didn't know what happened in his earlier life, and he's not a man who has any ability to look inwards, to introspect. And it's quite difficult to pace the story, especially when the story is everything. And, you know, to me, it was a bit like trying to write a sort of perfect 3-minute pop song. And, you know, if you asked a serious musician who normally writes, you know, hour-long symphonies, do you think you can knock off a Beach Boys or a Beatles song in 3 minutes? They'd say, sure, yeah, sure. But actually, when you come to do it, it's not as easy as it looks.
Well, the new James Bond book does have all the classics in there. There's a villain with a deformity, I should say, a hand like an ape, a hairy hand. There's a psychopathic killer named Chagrin. That was a nice touch. Did you worry about veering into parody?
My view is when you're doing parody, you take all the characteristics of the author and then you exaggerate them. So you do like 125% of the given author. With Ian Fleming, what I tried to do was do about 75%. So I thought, what really works in these books? What do we like? We like Bond, we like the girls. So I thought, well, okay, let's have two girls. Why not? We like girls, so let's have two of them. What don't we like? We don't like it when the names get too silly. We don't like it when the plots get too far-fetched, so we didn't do that. And sometimes Ian Fleming had a tendency to show off a bit about how much he knew. For instance, the first part of From Russia with Love, there's a lot of showing off about how much he knew about the Russian Secret Service. So no long, slow passages, just constant movement and action.
I think a lot of people have their own era of James Bond. Maybe it's reading the books as a child. Maybe it's one of the particular movie Bonds, Sean Connery, Roger Moore. But after a while, everyone moves on a little bit from James Bond. Did you sort of fall back in love with this character?
I did fall back in love with him a bit. When you read the books in chronological order, you see just how incredibly appealing he must have been to Britain in the late 50s, early 60s. And we were a country who had won with the Americans and the Russians the Second World War, but at what great price? I mean, when I was born, rationing was still going on. We were poor, we'd lost the empire. You couldn't travel abroad because you couldn't take more than a small amount of money out of the country. It was always raining. And suddenly along comes this guy who the adventures he has make it seem as though Britain is still or was still a sort of real power in the world. And as Fleming pointed out, the sun is always shining in Bond books. But what I think what I sort of fell back in love with was this loner. He is completely alone in his well-cut Savile Row suit and his soft shoes and his one hopelessly underpowered gun. And he finds himself facing dreadful danger. And, you know, it does remind someone of my age how I grew up expecting in Western Europe to be annihilated more or less any time in the Cold War. We were on a state of permanent alert. There is still resonance in that, the resourcefulness of one rather cold-hearted but very quick-witted man pitted against a huge, a vast, implacable enemy.
Thanks for being with us, Sebastian.
Thank you, Robert. It's been a pleasure.
Sebastian Foakes is the author of the new James Bond book, Devil May Care. You can read an excerpt and get more great summer reading recommendations at npr.org/summerbooks.
Good morning, I'm Renee Montaigne. A government known for restricting the internet now has friends on Facebook. A page went up for China's premier Wen Jiabao right after the earthquake. As of this morning, he's collected 14,000 supporters. That's what Facebook calls friends of politicians. His friendly supporters are mostly writing in to hail his quick and personal response to China's disaster, gushes one, a model premier for the world.